We've been working on chapter 11 a long time. So are we there yet? Well, not quite. I guess it all depends on where you're going, right? If you get there yet. Now, these first two slides here have to do with an issue that just came up this past couple of weeks. And you may have seen it in the news, but it relates to what we talked about in our last lesson. That's why I brought them in here. You know, you get stuff and you say, oh, that goes with last week's, you know, lesson. Okay. The American Archbishop, who heads the Vatican Supreme Court, said Catholic politicians who support abortion rights should not receive the sacraments, including funeral rites. Now, this man here, Raymond Burke, is the head of the Vatican's Supreme Tribunal of the Apostolic Signatura. That's the Catholic Church's Supreme Court. And he spoke out against something that happened here recently. Burke said, it is not possible to be a practicing Catholic and to conduct oneself in this manner. Neither Holy Communion nor funeral rites should be administered to such politicians. Do you know who he's talking about? Senator Edward Kennedy. And this came after Senator Edward Kennedy's funeral. Because Burke said that because Kennedy supported abortion rights and homosexuality rights, that he should not have been buried in a Catholic church with full Catholic church funeral rites. That's what this comment's about. So, I just thought that was interesting because, if you'll remember what we studied last time, no Christian could hope for salvation who was not in all things an obedient son of the church and who was not ready to take up arms in its defense. The papal mandate, just or unjust, reasonable or unreasonable, was to be received and implicitly obeyed, for there was no appeal from the representative of St. Peter, for the destiny of all men lay in the hands which could administer or withhold the sacraments essential to salvation. Is that not what we just read from Raymond Burke? He says that sacraments should be withheld from people who don't, you know, yeah. The reason I'm bringing this out is because I want to show how what we read here on this slide, the destiny of all men lay in the hands which could administer or withhold the sacraments to salvation. What are the sacraments? Infant baptism, marriage, confirmation, communion, the last rites in Catholic funeral. Those are all part of it. And if anybody thinks that he can has in his hand and has in his ability to withhold salvation from you, is he right? Salvation is between you and God, right? No man can stand between you and God. The concept that we saw in the last lesson where the church used this power over the people to control the people is not dead. That's my point. Let's go back to Scripture. Revelation chapter 11. I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,200 and 80 days clothed in sackcloth. This is a review, very quick review here, because we need to keep getting it in our minds so we understand this. It will be a test later, right? Okay. So who are the two witnesses? Old and New Testaments. How long are they to prophesy? 1,260 years. Why are they in sackcloth?
Persecution.
And
it wasn't allowed to be, it was only in one language, an unwritten, an unknown language for people.
Right. So the Bible was only in Latin. It was locked up in churches and monasteries, and people had no access to it. Okay, so that's the sackcloth part.
That's what Luther objected to.
The ones up in the mountains.
Yeah, the Waldenses, the Albigenses, the Pollicans. Right, we'll get into that in chapter 12, if we ever get there. Okay. From the close of the 14th century, when Wycliffe's translation of the Bible placed the Word of God into the hands of the common people of England, until the full dawn of the Reformation, the restraint which had long been placed on Scriptures was gradually removed. Now, the restraint is this prophesying in sackcloth that we talked about here. And Wycliffe was one of the first to translate the Bible out of Latin. He was like about 1350 that he was doing his work. They persecuted him so severely that even he died a natural death. But they dug his bones up and burned them and threw them in the river.
Mm-hmm. And that's very symbolic of what happened to the Bible.
Absolutely, yeah. But anyway, the point being that, you know, the church was very against the Bible being in the common language. Mm-hmm. What happened to 508? This is your test. Yes? Anybody know? We've covered this how many times? Nobody remembers. 508. Clovis was baptized. Who was Clovis?
King.
King of the Franks. King of the Franks. Okay. He was one of the first ones of the tribes of the 10 tribes of Europe to convert to Catholicism, and he supported the papacy from his beginning. And so did all of his children. So Clovis was the first barbaric tribe that converted into Catholicism, and his nation followed him. His nation was, or became, France. Right. Okay, that's the point of the last lesson, was that from the beginning, France has supported the papacy. Okay, what happened in 533? Justinian's decree that said the Pope had full power as corrector of heretics, and it was the beginning of the war against three Arian tribes that refused to bow to the bishop at Rome. Okay, 538. The three tribes were finally, okay, the last one that went down was the Ostrogoths. Okay, so the Arian tribes all fall. The Vandals went first, no, the Heruli went first, then the Vandals, and then the Ostrogoths. Okay. When Justinian first mediated the conquest of Italy, he sent ambassadors to the kings of the Franks. These were actually Clovis's sons by this time, and adjured them by the common ties of alliance and religion to join in the holy enterprise against the Arians. Now, the common alliance here was the promise of the kings to support the papacy with their military and the common religion. So this was unique. With the conquest of Rome by Belisarius in 538, the history of the ancient city of Rome may be considered as terminating and commences the history of the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages are also known as the Dark Ages because learning and books and education of any kind whatsoever was done away with. From the time of the popes, more and more involved in worldly events no longer belong solely to the church. They are men of the state and then rulers of the state. They move from the religious realm into the political realm. This is an important fact, and it will come again later in our study as an important fact. So we established these three principles last time. That France was the handmaiden of the papacy from Clovis the Frank beginning in 508. Papal domination of political powers began in 800 with what happened in 800? Close. Not Constantine, no.
That's when the Pope got.
Okay, that's why we repeat. 800, oh, I'll forgive you, you weren't here. 8800 was when the Holy Roman Empire was officially begun with the crowning of Charlemagne as Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Charlemagne gave total support to the papacy. He would do whatever the Pope wanted, and he went out and conquered more of the European territory and brought it under papal rule. Okay? And then union of church and state as a papal strategy for political and ecclesiastical world domination. As long as the Pope is in charge, he gets what he wants from the kings, right? Okay, that's the whole point. But it is separation of church and state that makes this nation of ours, America, free. And all citizens in America are free to worship according to their individual consciences. This is a unique thing. There's not another nation in the world that has such freedom, because they either have no religion or they have state-supported religions. I mean, even in England, you know, it's a state-supported religion. In this country, according to our constitutional rights, It is unique. Every person in this country can worship as they choose or not to. There is no coercion from the government whatsoever, or from any church leader whatsoever. That's why we study history. That's why we're studying these lessons here. Because if we don't understand the danger of the union of church and state, we'll give up our freedoms in this country. Well, they're being hammered at. That's true. But union of church and state has always brought persecution. Always. What did we say happened in 508? You got to go at this again, see?
Clovis
was baptized. 533? Justinian's decree, which gave the Pope or the Bishop, he wasn't called Pope then, but the Bishop at Rome, full powers, corrector of heretics. 538, the Arians all fall. I'll just give this to you. You're, okay. 750, we studied this pretty extensively last time.
Pepin!
And what? Yeah, that's what I know. She's taking notes. Somebody ought to have the answer here. Pepin did what? Who was Pepin?
He was short.
Yeah, he was known as Pepin the Second. He was also known as Pepin the Short because there were several Pepins. Pepin was a king of the Franks. And who was Pope at the time? Stephen the Second. So we got Pepin and Stephen, and they're in having this major discussion over who is in control. Pepin thought he was in control. He was the king. He said, I have the military. That gives me the power. The Pope says, no, you don't. I have the power because it was given to me by Peter. And he produced a document known as the Donation of Constantine. That's what you were going to say, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, that happened 750.
When you said 800, I was thinking.
Okay, sorry for the confusion. This donation of Constantine was a false document, absolutely correct. Stephen created it, wrote it up, then he handed it to Pepin. He said, see, Constantine is the one that gave me my power. My power goes all the way back to Constantine. Is that true? No. What did we just look at happened in 533? It's right there on the screen. Justinian's the one that handed down the letter, not Constantine. So they didn't understand their history either, right? You know, Stephen knew that something had happened. He got a letter from somebody that gave him power, but he didn't know who it was. So he said it was Constantine. Well, it wasn't Constantine. It was Justinian. So see, it's important that you understand your history. Okay, 800. Charlemagne is named the Holy Roman Emperor. And from that point on, a very important prophecy was fulfilled in Revelation 17. 533. I'm not going to make you do this again. Holy Roman Empire was formed.
Yeah, the Holy Roman Empire was formed and everybody bowed the knee to the Roman Catholic.
Okay, Holy Roman Empire is formed in AD 800. The prophecy that's fulfilled is Revelation 17, where it says, the woman rides the beast. What's a woman in prophecy? A church. Which, a beast?
A
nation, country, power, whatever, okay? It's not a literal animal. In 8800, the woman, the church, had power and control over the state. There was union of church and state, and the church was in charge. And that fulfills the prophecy in Revelation 17, where it says the woman rides the beast. That's right.
They did what the Pope wanted them to do.
That's right.
It was like, you know.
Kind of like blackmail.
It was,
yeah,
in a way. Okay. And I don't think we'll get into it here, but there was a King Henry, I think his name was, who defied the Pope, and the Pope stood him up. I mean, you know, heard him out. And so in the middle of winter, the king had to walk from France to Rome. Of course, by that time, the Pope had said, well, I'm not going to meet him in Rome. And he went to Canossa. The Pope had to walk the king had to walk from Rome to Canossa again. And when he got to the king made him stand out in the snow for 3 days before he let him in the door. That's the power that the Pope had. And it was through what we covered here with the statement of Raymond Burke. They thought that their salvation was lost if they didn't do everything that the Pope told them to do. And if you defied the Pope, he could excommunicate you, and that was it. You had no hope. So it was a powerful, coercive mechanism.
And all because nobody had the Bible.
That's exactly right. Nobody had the Bible, so they couldn't verify for themselves what was right. So, 1793, we haven't covered this yet. Anybody got an idea what happened in 1793? No.
This was the uprising.
No. The uprising started in 1789. Remember on the slide there I said I didn't make a typo? It really was 1789. The French Revolution actually started. The first revolt process began in 1789. Okay, 1793, they guillotined King Louis XVI. If you put this together, in 1733, Justinian's decree went out that gave the Pope power over everything. 120 years later, 1793, the king is killed by rebels. That's 1260 years. But that's not the fulfillment of the prophecy. It's just curious that you get two dates that work together. But the fulfillment of the prophecy was in 1798, because 533 was a decree, but they didn't control all the tribes until 538. That's when the prophecy began. So 1260 years later was 1798. And what happened in 1798? Pope was taken captive.
That's more of a fulfillment of the prophecy too.
Absolutely. That is the fulfillment of the prophecy.
Yeah, but the 1260 days couldn't end on 1793 because the
Catholic Church didn't fall. No, that's right, because the prophecy had to do with the beginning and the ending of the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Okay? So, full power was given 538, full power was removed in 1798, fulfilled the 1260-year prophecy. Pope Pius VI was arrested in Rome and he died the next summer, 1799. So we have 1260 years of prophecy. The prophecy is absolutely accurate, cannot be denied, it applies here. Now we're studying this history because we want to show why all the futurism notions out there are inaccurate, where they take this prophecy in chapter 11. That's why I have spent so many weeks on chapter 11, is because most everybody out there says, oh no, the two witnesses are Moses and Elijah. The two witnesses are going to rise from the dead. The two witnesses are going to prophesy for 3.5 years, and then they're going to be killed, and they're going to lay in the streets, and their blood's going to run, whatever. This is the prophetic understanding that you get off the TV from John Hagee, from Tim LaHaye, from the Left Behind series books. They're all teaching this. It is not true. And we've just shown how the prophecy was fulfilled in history. History is accurate. Men's theories are not. This is a picture of them taking the Pope. He was 82 years old when Berthier came into Rome and arrested him. It took several months for them to haul him back to France. And when they got him to France, he died August 29, 1799. The death of the head of the Roman Catholic Church correlates to the conquest of the last Arian tribe in AD 538. Napoleon gave orders when Pope Pius died that there would not be another pope appointed. And it took 5 years to get another pope. So in essence, the prophecy here that we read in Revelation 13, that the deadly wound, this beast with a deadly wound, that's what this is talking about, is taking Pope Pius VI captive. Okay, back to the scripture. And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them. When they have finished their testimony, is the Bible done? We don't need it anymore? What's this talking about?
When the testimony comes to fruition,
when the prophecy is fulfilled, and when they had finished their testimony in sackcloth, because that's what the previous verse said, right? And remember, we read the statement there about Wycliffe, and the Bible is being translated and gradually comes out of that darkness and comes back into the hands of the people? Okay, the Word of God gradually came out of the obscure language of Latin, gradually was published and put into the hands of the people. So it's this waking up thing. But there's something worse that's going to come. This beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit is going to make war against them. It's going to be worse than persecution, and shall overcome them and kill them. So there will be an attempt to destroy the Bible altogether, not just locking it up in a monastery someplace. In the year 1793, 1260 years from the letter of Justinian, declaring the Pope universal bishop, the gospel was, by a solemn act of the legislature and the people, abolished in France. By the decree of the French government, declaring that the nation acknowledged no God, the Old and New Testaments were slain throughout the limits of Republican France. The symbolism of the prophecy makes a striking picture of an attack to be made upon the two witnesses, the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. It was to come just as the great prophetic period of the 1260 years of papal supremacy was ending. And at the same time, one of the 10 parts of the mystical city, and the mystical city is Rome. Pagan Rome had how many parts?
Ten.
What's the prophecy say? 10 heads, you know, a beast with 10 heads, 7 horns. That's Daniel. Okay, the 7 horns, it only had 7, it had 10 heads and 7 horns. How come? Because three Aryan tribes were destroyed. Okay, we've got to put this together. Okay, it had the pagan Rome had 10 heads. 10 nations were under the, came out of the pagan Rome. At the time of the 533, 538 dates, you know, four of them actually were still Aryan. One capitulated, three were destroyed. That left 10 heads, but only 7 powers. So we had 7 horns. So what he says here, at the same time, one of the 10 parts of the mystical city, one of these leftover heads of the mystical city of Rome, of the prophecy, is overturned by an earthquake, and it was just at this time that the earthquake of the French Revolution came. So what he's talking about is this one head of the 7 remaining is France, and the earthquake of the French Revolution overturns it. When we read here in the prophecy, what is it, chapter, verse 13, about the earthquake, that is not talking about the Lisbon earthquake, 1755. The Lisbon earthquake was a terrible earthquake, and there was 60,000 people, I think, destroyed in Lisbon alone from the tsunami that came through. It was a terrible earthquake and tsunami. That's not what the earthquake means here. The earthquake is the earthquake of the French Revolution. And their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. From that one verse, and their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually was called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified, we've got to figure out some things. First, we've got to figure out who is, or what is, the beast from the bottomless pit.
Thank you.
True. You've read his book. But before we go there, I want to go to another prophecy that correlates with this prophecy in chapter 11. And it's from Daniel 11. We'll also find out how does this prophecy apply to Egypt and Sodom, but that's going to have to be in the next lesson. How is Christ crucified? That'll be in the next lesson. So the prophecy that's going to help us understand what's going on here in Revelation 11 is Daniel chapter 11. Very interesting that Daniel and Revelation go together. They explain each other. So let's read the prophecy. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all, but in his estate shall he honor the God of forces. And a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver. This is Daniel 11, verses 36 and 38. Now, you pick up commentaries, and I've got probably 8 different commentaries, all different denominations. And it's mixed as to who this he is that's being talked about here in chapter 11 of Daniel. Some of them say it's Antiochus Epiphanes. And I just kind of laughed when I read that, because I thought, wait a minute, you already told me Antiochus Epiphanes was the fulfillment of this prophecy that was, you know, earlier on. So how can he be filling this prophecy too? I mean, it's like, if you can't figure the prophecy out, you just say it's Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the scapegoat for anything you don't understand. You just say it was him. Well, it wasn't him. Other commentators say that this prophecy was fulfilled by the papacy. Well, could be, but probably not. Because there's a better understanding if you understand that all the characteristics that are outlined in these two verses here were fulfilled in the French Revolution. So let's look at that. A king or a beast in prophecy is a political power of a nation, not a single individual, right? Okay. This power arose at the time of the end. When was Antiochus Epiphanes?
Before Christ.
Before Christ. So that's not the time of the end. No? Okay. So, but the prophecy here in Daniel says that this power is going to arise at the time of the end. So that pretty well tells us that we got to put it somewhere out here, you know, towards the end of the time, right? So it can't be Antiochus Epiphanes. This power or political nation worshipped force, violence, and human reason as gods, rejected the God of his fathers. So the French Revolution rejected every power except the power of the directorate. When they brought out the guillotine, they slaughtered people. There was about 250 people a day that died in Paris. Every day during the Reign of Terror. Thousands, tens of thousands of people were slaughtered in that 3.5 years. What were some of the things that France did which caused it to be labeled atheistic and anti-God? Well, it rejected the Creator God and everything that God had ordained for the welfare of mankind. Not only was the Creator God rejected, but the things that he ordained for mankind from creation were rejected, including the 7-day week. They rejected marriage, family, seven-day week, Sabbath, marriage and family were all ordained by God from the creation of this world. Marriage and divorce could be obtained simply by saying the word. I don't want you anymore, get out of here. That's all it took to get a divorce. Men had serial wives. He had a wife in this house and he had a wife in another house. Didn't matter. Children, if they didn't want them, they dumped them out in the streets and let them run. The conditions under the French Revolution were horrific. I mean, it's horrible to read about what they did. So they rejected the sacredness of marriage and family. France is the only nation in the world concerning which the authentic record survives that as a nation she lifted her hand in open rebellion against the author of the universe. There's no other nation on the face of the earth, not even communist China, today, that has done this. I've created a chart here, and we'll hand it out at the end, that will kind of put this on a timeline for you. I couldn't give the whole history of the French Revolution on one sheet of paper, but I've condensed it as best I could for you. But from this chart and from history, we see that France is an exact fulfillment of this prophecy, both in Daniel 11 and in Revelation 11. If we search the annals of the world, we shall not find even a private society or a sect, much less a civil community and state, which before our day has in the most public manner proclaimed to all the nations around it that there is no God, and made that proposition the basis of the constitution of its government. These quotes I'm giving you here, I know that I'm going to be reading a lot of slides. It's because I don't want you to go out of here and say, Ann said so-and-so. I didn't say so-and-so. It's not my history. I didn't create this history. I got the history from people who wrote it. This quote is from 1802. He probably was alive during the French Revolution because the French Revolution was still going on in 1802. He knew what he was talking about. He was an eyewitness. One of the quotes I've got here, I don't know if it was on this week's or next week's, was an eyewitness to the events that took place. The revolution in France rejected the God-given 7-day week, and in its place they created a 10-day week. So they had 30 days in their months, and at the end of the year they had 5 days left over because that's just the way it worked out. Well, they had 5 days, didn't they, to do something with? So they named them all different festivals, and it was just total chaos with their festivals and their revelry and their whatever. I mean, it was like Mardi Gras 100 times over with everything that they did. Then they started their new year. Well, I printed off their calendar. It's incredible, because every day honors a different thing, you know, from creation. So they were basically creation worshipers. They honored, you know, I forget the names, because they're all French names and French letters and designations and whatnot. But say today, on their French calendar, they would honor a daisy. And then tomorrow they're going to honor a lion. And then the next day they're going to honor a rock and, you know, whatever. So every day, I mean, there's no way you could keep track of what you had to have the calendar written out, or you couldn't keep track of what you were doing day to day. This new power exalted itself above every power, religious and political. They rejected God, they rejected the church, and they rejected the king. Deified, not defied, but deified, made a god out of brute force and reason. This was all based on the teachings of people, men like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire. Voltaire himself said, y'all say that it took, he didn't quite say it like that, but if 12 men was what it took to establish Christianity, one man shall tear it down. Speaking of himself and his own writings. The Duke of Orleans, 40 of the nobility, and 200 of the clergy now joined in the rebellion against the king and the church. The clergymen saw that if they were going to survive, they better join the rebellion, because heads were rolling. This picture here is a picture of the National Assembly that had formed to overthrow itself against the king. Now, they had already arrested the king and brought, no, I know they hadn't, not at this point, but the king held, King Louis the 16th held an assembly of the estates. There was 3 estates in France. One was the church, one was the and nobility, one was the king and the nobility. So you had the church, the king and the nobility, and then everybody else. The church and the nobility constituted 3% of the population. Everybody else was 97% of the population. They had not had a national assembly for several hundred years, wherein everybody came and represented and discussed state affairs. When the king saw that he was having trouble from that 97% out there, he decided to have a national assembly. So he invited all of his nobles and the clergy and the third estate, it was called, this 97%, to come to this meeting. Well, when he got there, he locked out the representatives from the 97%. The only ones that were allowed in the room was the nobles and the clergy. So the 97% said, that's fine. And they went over to what was called the tennis court, and that's what this picture is here, and they held their own meeting. And in that meeting, they said, we don't care about the nobles and the king and the church anymore. And they organized themselves into a national assembly, and they wrote their own constitution. Well, at this point, King Louis decided, I got problems. But he didn't know how to fix it. So some of the clergy at this point said, maybe it's best if we just kind of join with the rebels. It's the only way we're going to survive. They could see the end coming here. So they did. But by joining with the rebels, they had to overthrow the church. And by joining with the rebels, they became subservient to the state. And they became employees of the state. So now we have a complete turnover from what it has been for 1260 years, right? To begin with, it was the church that was in control of the state. Now we've got the state in control of the church. Still union of church and state. It's just turned upside down. Didn't work any better either. When you have union of church and state, no matter who's in charge, it doesn't work. The first atheistic act was the introduction of the Republican calendar, in which a decade, deca, 10, of the 10 days was substituted for the immemorial 7-day week. Now, immemorial means that it exists outside of memory. Nobody can remember any time that there's ever been anything other than a 7-day week. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 to Genesis chapter 2, verse 2, gives us the outline of where that first week came from. That first week ended with a seventh-day Sabbath that God honored, hallowed, and rested on, right? And from creation, we have the seventh-day Sabbath. And the tenth day was instituted as a day of rest in place of the Sabbath. With the introduction of a new calendar, the Christian dating of the years was also discontinued. Now, the Christian dating of the years, how does that work? This is, what, 2009 A.D.? Mm-hmm. Moses lived in what era? B.C., before Christ? Okay. A.D. does not mean after death. It means Anno Domini, which is the year of our Lord. So all time is centered around Christ. Before Christ, time after Christ, or the years of our Lord. Not according to revolutionary France. They said, nope, we're going to start time again. We have our own new calendar. Time began with the French Revolution, as far as they were concerned. No time existed prior to that. So we had year one of the French Revolution, which was February, not February, 1792 anyway. The new era was inaugurated. The French era was to succeed the Christian era, now abolished in France. If it was no longer the Christian era, what was it? It was an anti-Christian era, right? And everything that they did was anti-Christian. An era without God, without the Bible, without Christ as Savior of the world, without any concept of righteous by faith. Nothing whatsoever. Henceforth, the years were to date not from the birth of Christ, but from the birth of the French Republic, September 22, 1792, which was now day one, year one, as far as France was concerned. They no longer called it September 22, 1792. So, we have quite an upheaval here, right? A new order of things. An upheaval in religion and politics. That's what the prophecy is talking about. That's the earthquake that verse 13 is talking about. Okay. So what's the beast from the bottomless pit? Tori already told us. Atheism. We've established that France during their revolution outlawed religion throughout all France. They attempted to wipe out the Bible. Anybody who owned a Bible was arrested and had your head cut off. They gathered up the Bibles and burned them in the streets by heaps. Had great bonfires of Bibles.
And who is the one that did that? That was
the French revolutionaries.
And they're under the king?
No, the king's dead.
Who is over them?
The initial, the picture of the tennis court thing there, they were fairly represented. They had, I don't know, several hundred people that were there that were deciding the Constitution. And they wrote a Constitution at that time. They stayed in session until they came out with a Constitution that they thought was fair to the common man. Well, it didn't take long before the Directorate took over, and the Directorate was five men. I don't remember all the men's names, but one of them was, Robespierre. And Robespierre was one of the five directorates. So it ended up being from a fair representation, number-wise, and they wrote a couple of constitutions to Robespierre coming into power, and Robespierre then was one of the five directorate, and they became nothing but five dictators. Under Robespierre and the directorate was the Reign of Terror. You'll see that on the chart here. Under the Reign of Terror, heads rolled by the bunch. The guillotine was invented by a French doctor because they were trying to be merciful. We're going to kill you, but we're going to be merciful about it. Now, if we shoot you, that's not so merciful. You know, you might not die right away. Chop your head off, you're going to die real quick. So this doctor, whose name was Guillotine, figured out how high he had to drop the blade, and you know, he figured this all out so that when it came down, it was quick death, you were over. We knew when we dropped the blade, you're going to die. Nobody's going to survive this. You might survive hanging. People have survived hanging. You might survive being shot, but not the guillotine. And hundreds every day died in Paris. That's where the guillotine was used most. Okay, let's get on with the beast from the bottomless pit. The beast from the bottomless pit is not a nation. It is an ideology, international in extent. France was the concrete agent which initiated the change, but it was the ideology then dominating the directory, these five men I just talked about, the ruling power in Paris, which was behind the change. It was a fundamental change of ideas. What Revelation calls the beast in the bottomless pit or the abyss was a new manifestation of satanic power. It was Satan turned loose. Satan has always hated God. He has always hated the Bible. He has always hated Christ. He attempted to destroy God's work in this world when he killed Christ. In 1700s, late 1700s, he tried once again through the nation of France, because the work that was going on in France was to be an international work. The men that were in the sub-level of this that most people didn't know about, they were there, Adam Weishaupt and the Jacobins, you know, they were working in a way to subvert all of government everywhere. And actually what came out of the French Revolution is alive and well this day in any form of communism in the world. That notion of communism was, the egg was laid in the French Revolution. The power symbolized in Revelation 11:7 by the beast from the bottomless pit, which made deadly war on the Bible at the time of the French Revolution, we have named it organized atheism, infidelity on a national scale. Because there is no God, man can behave like he wants. Murder is not murder. It's expediency. Thievery, whatever. I mean, any one of the Ten Commandments, every one of the Ten Commandments, I should say, was broken in France during this time. There was no law at all, no law of God. The law of the land changed day by day. During that reign of terror, it was illegal one day to do something, and the next day it was okay, but something else was illegal, and you couldn't keep track of what you had to do to be in compliance with the law. And they killed you if you had more food in your house than your neighbor did, or what they thought you should have. I mean, they killed you for every reason that you could think of. You never knew whether you were safe or not. Even people who were working with the revolution might end up with their head chopped off. It was a terrible time, that reign of terror. This organized atheism, infidelity on a national scale, is that the same ideology came again, was manifested in the European revolutions of 1848, when they went on and killed some more kings. And it manifested itself again during the Russian Revolution in 1917, under the Marxist Revolution. Brought down the monarchy in Russia and instituted communism. We saw it yet again in Germany beginning in 1933. People thought Nazism was a Christian religion. They thought that it supported Christianity, but it didn't. The same underlying ideology was what we saw in France. And of course, it's what we have in communist Russia. The ideology is not dead. The notions are not dead. They live on continually. The notions that arose in revolutionary France affect this country in our educational system, in our religious system, because the basic notion that came out of there has of Voltaire and Jean-Jacques Rousseau has developed into today's postmodern attitude. That there is no law, I can do what I want. I am the measure. Man is the measure, not God, not God's law. On the 26th of August, 1792, an open profession of atheism was made by the whole nation, once zealously devoted to papal superstition. Now, the whole history of what I showed you in the last few lessons and what we reviewed this morning was the establishment of the papacy in 538 and its control over the government. Now we see that with this atheism, they turned on the papacy, turned on the church, and they turned on the king and said, "We are a law unto ourselves." They wrote several constitutions within just a few years. The American Constitution has stood for how long? It was ratified in 1789. When did the French Revolution first get rolling? 1789. The French thought they were copying the American way of doing things. They thought that they were taking the American principles of revolution, the American principles of government, and they were going to do the same thing in France. But they threw out God. And when they did that, it meant that their constitutional government was going to be a failure. God was rejected throughout France. France is the only nation that ever openly denied the existence of the deity and set up a worship recognizing no other ruler than the goddess of reason. Now this picture here, I don't know if you can see it very well. They took a woman. Some have said that she was a prostitute, but whether she was or not, I don't know. But she was an actress in the theater, and she was married to one of the revolutionaries, and they placed her up on this platform and carried her through the streets of Paris and took her to the Notre Dame Cathedral and seated her in the Notre Dame Cathedral as the goddess of reason. Proponents of the French Revolution appealed to human reason to justify the universality of human rights. In stark contrast to the French revolutionaries, the American founding fathers appealed to the rights endowed by our Creator. That's a distinct difference between their revolution and the American Revolution. Jean-Jacques Rousseau preached the alluring doctrine that the primitive state of man was one of virtue and happiness from which man had declined through the rather inexplicable activities of priests, kings, lawyers, and the like. This 97%, the third estate in France, decided that they didn't like the activities of the kings or the church or the lawyers or anybody that was educated. What did Pol Pot do? Remember Pol Pot over there, wherever he was?
Cambodia.
In Cambodia? Yeah, remember what he do? You know what his underlying theology was? Anybody that was educated died. If you wore glasses, that meant you were educated because you could read. Why would you need glasses if you couldn't read? You died. Sort of the same idea in France, revolutionary France. So this third estate rose up and said that the primitive state of man is one of virtue and happiness. We're only unhappy because we've got law, because we've got God, and because we've got government. That's what makes us unhappy. So if we get rid of those, we can be happy. If we have no restraint on what I want to do, I can be happy. We've got children in this church. Are they happy when they're running wild?
No.
No. Are they happy when mama says, no, don't do that?
No.
Behave yourself? Yes. That's when they're happy. You put a fence around a horse. He's happier when he knows he's got a home. God gave us the law as a hedge against sin. The Ten Commandment law is not there in order to make us unhappy. The Ten Commandment law is not, thou shalt not do this because I don't want you to be happy. That was the sin that Satan told Eve, right? If you eat this fruit, then you're going to find out all those things that God doesn't want you to know. Well, it's true. God didn't want us to know about sin. So the devil didn't lie. God never wanted his human family to know anything about sin. He only wanted us to know goodness and to be happy. But because Eve listened to the devil, sin entered this world. And we've been unhappy ever since because we've been kicking against the law. And we've said that law is a restraint and I don't like it. I'm going to be free. I'm going to worship on Sunday. Well, it's the same notion. Note in this statement here of Rousseau's, that his ideas did away with sin and any accountability to a holy God. You could do what you wanted. Didn't matter. No accountability. When you died, you died. That's it. No judgment. Doesn't matter. Men were viewed as a law unto themselves. The Bible talks about that. Judges 21:25. So after all, you remember the book of Judges? And the book of Judges was all about all these people who, you know, they would follow God for a little while. And then they'd fall away. And there'd be terrible persecution, and the Philistines would come and get them, and then whatever. And then they'd get unhappy, and they'd cry to God, oh, come save us. And God would send them a judge. And as long as they had a judge, and the judge was telling them what to do, then everything was okay. But when the judge would die, then they'd fall away again, and they'd go back to worshiping idols, and they'd become persecuted by the Philistines. And, you know, this went on and on and on. Well, the end of the book of Judges said, every man did what was right in his own eyes. Same thing happened in the French Revolution. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And that is the fundamental philosophy of the postmodern era that we live in today. I can believe something, and you can believe something, but what I believe doesn't necessarily have to be what you believe, and it doesn't matter if we don't believe the same thing. As long as you're happy believing what you believe and I'm happy believing what I believe, we'll all get along. There is no law except my wish. What caused all this mess? What in the world could have caused all this upheaval? This rejection of God, rejection of government. What caused it was abuse. Abuse from the church and abuse by the government. The opinions of intelligent men at the time generally attributed the French Revolution to religious decay. And we studied that in the last lesson. Remember all the things that had gone on in the church. In short, to the errors and defects of popery we cannot but impute in a great degree the origin or the original of the revolutionary spirit which has gone so far toward the subversion of the ancient establishments of religion and civil government. By the abuses of religion, such minds have been led into all the extravagancies of deism and atheism, of revolution and anarchy. What's the difference between deism and atheism?
Atheism is no god, and deism is many gods.
No, polytheism is many gods. Poly means plural. Deism recognized that there was a God and that he was the creator. When you read the Constitution of the United States, it mentions creator God. People like to say, oh, this proves it's a Christian nation. Not necessarily. Because a deist will accept that there is a creator God. But a deist says there is a creator God, and he's like the watchmaker. He made the watch, he wound it up, he turned it loose. He has nothing more to do with it. It's up to man to then go on and do what he's got to do. That's what deism believes. Atheism, like Gerald said, is there is no God. I can do what I want to. I'm not accountable to anybody. Deism at least recognizes that you are accountable to somebody. Deism is a moral religion, not an amoral religion. Atheism is an amoral religion. It recognizes no moral attitude. Deism is a moral religion. It recognizes that there is a holy God, and we're accountable to him.
This abuse by the religion and political power.
Yeah.
Basically, what happened is a backlash against that.
Absolutely.
And that's what we're starting to see today.
Absolutely. Next slide. At that time, during the French Revolution, books were written by the most subtle of their order, calculated to unhinge the mind from the truths of revelation, the Word of God, and to bring the gospel into contempt. Now, this author here, Ethan Smith, is in the middle of discussing an underlying movement that was seeking to control the whole of society. I mentioned this just a few minutes ago. Not just in France, but in all of Europe. And it did. The French Revolution came to an end, and Napoleon put himself in power as dictator of France, but the underlying movement didn't stop. The underlying movement spread out into the other nations of France and ended up with more wars in France. And in 100 years later, or 50 years later, in 1848, we had revolutions throughout all of France, throughout all of Europe. Voltaire, Ethan Smith is talking about here, he's relating that the disciples of Voltaire were working first through the educational system. Schools were where they infiltrated, because they knew that if you change the mind of a child, you change society eventually. Even if you can't change society right then, with the kids going home and saying, Mom, I want to do such and such. That happens today. And it changes the way parents vote, because what kids hear in school, right? So you do have that influence. But if you don't get that influence immediately, at least if you warp the minds of the children, eventually society is going to be changed. And that's what we're seeing right now, just like Tori said. The order that's being talked about here, the most subtle of their order, the order he's talking about here is the order of the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus. The Society of Jesus was first founded during the Counter-Reformation. You know what the Counter-Reformation was about? Why was there a Counter-Reformation?
To go against the Reformation.
You had the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, and then you had the Counter-Reformation by the Catholic Church seeking to overturn the work of the Reformation and bringing the people back to the Bible. Yeah, okay. So you have the Counter-Reformation. During the Counter-Reformation, this Society of Jesus was formed. They are better known as Jesuits, and the Jesuits were the papacy's response team, I guess is a good word in today's language. You have an incident, you have a response team that goes and takes care of it, right? they're trained, they understand things, and so this incident happens, the response team goes and takes care of it, whatever it is. You know, you have emergency response teams, you have, you know, terrorist response teams, you know, whatever, we've got response teams. So that's what the Jesuits did, and they worked to come up with theological positions to counter the work of the Protestant Reformation. It was a Jesuit named Francisco Ribera who, at the time of the Counter-Reformation, came up with a theory, theological theory, to take the heat off the papacy. Because during the Reformation, Luther was pointing the finger at the papacy. He says, the papacy is the fulfillment of these prophecies, right? The abuses that we see going on are fulfillment of these prophecies. So Francisco Ribera came up, and he said, oh no, and he wrote like a 500-page document that took all the pressure off the papacy. And he said, oh no, that's not going to happen. You know, the Pope is not responsible for any of this. The Church is not responsible for any of this. All this prophecy is true, but it hasn't happened yet. It's going to happen sometime out in the future, and we don't know when. So Antichrist, you know, it's going to come way sometime in the future. That's where we get futurism. Future times. Okay? So people who misunderstand the prophecies in Revelation 11, like I told you earlier, and think that the two witnesses are Elijah and Moses, they are working under the theory that Francisco Ribera developed as the Counter-Reformation. So people who promote this, and it's widely promoted by fundamentalist Christians, they are promoting a Counter-Reformation idea. They are working to undermine the Protestant Reformation, and they don't know it. Books teeming with the most artful suggestions of infidelity were profusely scattered throughout the whole mass of society. So whole books of a new order with new morals in them, or amorals, were being written. New concepts about religion, godless religion, new concepts about how society should be run. These books were published by the bunch, so that few or no good books could be found or in circulation in society. They weren't available. Book publishers and bookstores were listed in this cause. You know, Barnes & Noble, you know, I mean, Books A Million, you know, what kind of books they sell? You find very many Christian books? Well, few, you know, you got a few over there. But the majority of them are anti-religion, anti-God. Most novels that are purchased, people read novels by the bunch these days. They undermine moral concepts. They undermine concepts about God. We've got no business reading them. The emphasis here, no good books, is Ethan Smith's emphasis. There were plenty of books. There just weren't any good ones. The whole purpose for this work was to suppress every evangelical publication. So we didn't stop people from reading. We wanted people to be educated, but we didn't want them to be educated about the right kinds of things. What caused the French Revolution? Long-standing abuses by the Church for nearly 1,260 years, and I said nearly because the Revolution started before the end of the 1,260-year prophecy. Heavy taxation by the government and no representation of the lower classes. And they said, we will be represented. We're 97% of this population. New ideas overtaking the educational system, which resulted in a rejection of God and the Bible. Have we got new ideas overtaking our educational system? Remember, we talked about this. You can't get a book that's more than 10 years old in the library, right? And I heard someone talking here just a couple of weeks ago. They've got a child here in local high school. Actually, he's in junior high school. He reads very well. And he wanted to check out a book that was an 11th grade book. He's like in the 7th grade. He was told he couldn't have that book that was written. It's in the 11th grade section. And he went home and complained to his parents, and his mother called the librarian and said, why can't he check out this book? Oh, well, because that's an 11th grade book. Well, he reads on an 11th grade level. Why can't he read this book? Oh, well, because the books are age specific. Make sense? No. Because if the child can read, there shouldn't be any material in that book that's not sufficient for his age. A 7-year-old ought to be able to read on an 11th grade level. Without saying, oh, well, there might be something in that 11th grade book that we don't want little Johnny to read. It ought to all be moral. It ought to all be whatever. Are we there yet? No. But we will get there soon. This chart and all the lines and arrows and whatnot will seem rather confusing. But if you follow the lines and follow the arrows, it's not quite so confusing. The whole thing is the history of the French Revolution from 1789 to 1799, because that's when the revolution ended. Well, actually, 1804, when Napoleon became dictator. The first meeting, this says the States General. That was that council that I said was called by the king who realized that he was losing control of his country. And if he didn't do something, he didn't get a general assembly. That's about all this means, a States General. It's a general assembly of the people. And remember I said that he only allowed in the nobles and the clergy? He didn't allow in the common man. That took place. Well, all in that 1 year, we had the storming of the Bastille, the women's march against Louis XVI. I mean, the women rose up against him, and thousands of them marched out of Paris, out to the palace at Versailles, to tell the king that they were tired of being abused. So if you read that, then follow the arrows, you get more little information. So on a date, then underneath the date will be some information about what happened. That the things that are in bold are important topics. There's several things that happened all at one time. The Reign of Terror, what's going on at the same time as the Goddess of Reason. So I've got this marked in this little pinkish red. It's supposed to be red, but it came out kind of pinkish. What's in pink goes with the pink that's the comment there. And then here in the middle there, where it begins pink, come on down. The arrow starts there and comes down underneath that Reign of Terror comment down to the bottom. So follow your arrow down there and then follow the little crooked arrow over, because the Bible was undone for 3.5 years is what the prophecy said, and that's exactly correct. So you follow this line down there. November 26, 1793, the convention, 17 bishops and other clergymen decreed to abolish all religion throughout France. The clergy was involved in abolishing religion. Then it goes over to the next little thing over here, June 1797, 3.5 years after outlawing all religion in France, the same convention which decreed the Bible an illegal book changed its collective mind, and the Bible was declared an honorable book, and the ban was lifted on the Bible, and Protestant religion was then legal. Catholic religion was not. The Catholic religion was not reestablished until Napoleon reestablished it in 1801. That makes sense? Not yet, but you're going to go home and you're going to...